We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is going to be Rock Art Podcast number 59, just shy of number 60. And we have the furthest away gentleman who's going to be talking to us directly from Bangkok. His name is Dr. Noel Hidalgo Tan. His specialty is archaeology and rock art. And he's going to talk about the history and the prehistory of the study of rock art and the regional outreach and the remarkable relationship of some of the discoveries and the extraordinary field of archaeology and rock art out in Southeast Asia. Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel with your rock art podcast on the Archaeology Podcast Network. We are blessed and honored to have a gentleman that is probably the furthest afield in terms of geography that we've ever interviewed in the 60 episodes here. This is Dr. Noel Hidalgo Tan. He indeed is an eminent archaeologist from Southeast Asia. He does specialize in rock art, among other facets of the regional archaeology. Noel is known for quite a wide-ranging array of different accomplishments in many different areas. He has a background, wonderful discoveries at Angkor Wat. He also at work and specialized focused on some of his current projects in Southeast Asia. He does youth outreach and many other aspects of rock art and archaeology in general in Southeast Asia. Dr. Tan, are you there?
Hi, hello from Bangkok.
Yes, Bangkok. Can you imagine? That's a few miles away from Bakersfield, California.
It is just before 8 in the morning here.
Aye. And here it's about 6 p.m. So we're at least in the same we might be the same day. I don't know. Are you?
No. I'm coming from the future.
You're coming from the future. It's your one day future, and it's the day before Thanksgiving.
It is.
See, and I get an extra day on you. I know you like to be called Noel. You've told me about this. And I know we open it up in a variety of ways. I think the audience always wants to know a bit about your background and how you came to be associated with this discipline of anthropology, archaeology, the study of rock art and the religious area, etc. And of course, Southeast Asia itself. So why don't we kick it off with that question, and we'll see where it goes.
Sure. So
thank you so much for being one of our most honored guest scholars and coming from Southeast Asia.
Oh, I'm not sure. I'm not sure you might call me an honored guest once we're done with this. We'll take Southeast Asia as a very diverse place to begin with. And I come from an equally diverse background. So, like I said, I'm coming to you from Bangkok, but I am originally from Singapore, And I grew up there for most of my life. I then studied in, studied archaeology in Australia, came back to Singapore, worked a little while in a corporate job. I then did my master's in archaeology in Malaysia. And then I went back to Australia for my PhD. And then now I work here in Bangkok for the Regional Center for Archaeology and Fine Arts. And that is under a parent organization called the Southeast Asian Ministers of Education Organization.
Fascinating. I don't think we have something like that in the U.S., in the United States. I'm trying to think of what an analog would be for that particular entity. But it sounds,
it's not really easy for me to explain it to most people. I guess I would just call it a Southeast Asian version of UNESCO.
Oh, good, good. Yeah. So it sounds like it has a number of hats, and probably one of its jobs has to do with some of those remarkable archaeological manifestations of religious spheres that exist in Southeast Asia in terms of their preservation, research, and
it does.
And public interpretation, I would guess.
The Ministers of Education organization has its base in Bangkok, and then they have many centers. So there are many centers around the region. So like say in Singapore, where I'm from, you have the Center for English Language. In Malaysia, you have the Center for Mathematics and Science. And then in Thailand, one of the many centers they have is the Center for Archaeology and Fine Arts. So that's, you know, I'm in a sub-center of a larger regional organization.
What is your ethnic background and where did you grow up and how did you ever get interested in the study of archaeology?
So I am officially in Singapore, I would be classed as Chinese.
Okay.
My dad is Chinese. My mom is Filipina.
Ah.
So that explains the Hidalgo in my name.
That's a very interesting combination.
Yeah. So I'm not typically Singaporean, I think. I there aren't many Chinese Filipinos in Singapore, at least not when I was growing up. And certainly there isn't even, you know, when I grew up in Singapore, there wasn't even an archaeology department. No one really grows up to be an archaeologist. So to be, you know, to be an archaeologist in a country of 5 million, it's quite rare. There are more archaeologists in Singapore now, thankfully. But when I started out, I started out with the understanding that I was going to be an archaeologist and probably not be able to come back to Singapore to work. So it's really lucky that I did get a job within the region, working regionally. So I do get to travel quite a fair bit.
I presume that you, given you're from Southeast Asia and doing all this work in a variety of different countries, you must speak or at least be familiar with several different languages.
I can speak some. I can probably get away with, well, like say in Thailand, I can get away with being Thai for a minute. And then after that, then I'll realize, okay, he's not Thai. But he can still speak some Thai. So,
yeah.
And then usually I just break down and say, okay, I'm not Thai. Speak slowly or, but usually if the interactions are less than a minute, I'll get by.
Okay. So you understand some of the Southeast Asian languages?
I can order food for sure. I think it's really important to be able to know how to say hello, thank you, and where's the washroom. That's really the most important.
There you go, the critical elements. So you find yourself in an important or prominent position. You were saying that there aren't many archaeologists in Singapore per se, are there?
No, there's no formal field of study. So archaeologists in Singapore all have to study overseas. There isn't like a place that really employs archaeologists in Singapore. There are a couple now, academic departments that have an archaeologist too. So it's still mainly academia.
Yes.
Like say in the US where you have consultants, archaeologists or CRM work, you don't really have those in this part of the world.
Okay. So in terms of where your research is geographically centered, where would you say most of your studies have been conducted?
I specialize in the rock art of Southeast Asia.
That's a pretty big area, right?
It is. I've done most of my work in the mainland. So Thailand, Myanmar, Laos, Cambodia.
And tremendous ethnic diversity. and I would presume a grandiose historical thread going back hundreds, if not thousands of years.
Yes and no. There is a lot of rock art in Southeast Asia. Lots mm-hmm. of people don't realize that. Mm-hmm. They tend to be understudied for a variety of reasons that they tend to be remote places to begin with, not very well known unless you actually go out and look for them. In mm-hmm. most cases, you know, I rarely find something. Most of them are already known to local people.
Uh-huh.
And the nature of Southeast Asia is such that populations have been traditionally very mobile. So they move around a lot. So, you know, you don't have, like, say, in the rural areas, villages are maybe a few hundred years old. They've moved in from somewhere else.
Okay, gotcha. When you look at these rock art sites, do they stand out and distinctively represent the iconic elements of certain cultures? Can you immediately, almost in a transparent way, date them because of subject matter or because of the, you know, is there writing and literacy incorporated in those elements, or is it more difficult along the lines of some of the things we must do in North America?
In this part of the world, where I work is in mainland Southeast Asia,
yeah,
we usually just characterize rock art as rock art from the historic period and rock art from everything else that is not historic is prehistory. Which is really right, because prehistory can go all the way up to the last 100 years. We call it historic rock art because there are images that we can date. So, you know, if it's an image of the Buddha, it's mm-hmm. historic. It's an image of a Hindu god, it's historic. If it's an image of a car, it's historic. But by and large, you know, what we think of as prehistoric rock art, and that is the majority of the rock art in Southeast Asia, they are just largely defined by red paintings, period. So it's a very wide scope.
Is it religious traditions then, and the ethnic associations of those religious traditions that mark the various types and expressions of rock art in Southeast Asia for the historic complement?
Yes. So for the historic rock art, I can think of two classes. The ones we find in say, typically Buddhist Southeast Asia now, they are cave sites or rock shelters, and they are associated with a Buddhist tradition. So Theravada Buddhism is the main Buddhist tradition observed here, except for Vietnam.
And what ages are those? What did they go back to in terms of chronology for that Buddhist tradition?
So Theravada Buddhism came around the second millennium. And it comes in different forms. It comes through Sri Lanka around the 10th century, and then mm-hmm. it spreads from Sri Lanka to Myanmar to the rest of Southeast Asia.
Okay.
But, you know, there are other forms of Buddhism that are, in absolute terms, Buddhism came to Southeast Asia around the 4th century. Before that, you already had strands of Hinduism, like there were forms of Hindu gods being worshipped in Southeast Asia here. And so the things about these Indic religions is that they do tend to use caves as places of worship. And often that melds with a local tradition of animism. Most of Southeast Asia was animist, so we believed in nature spirits, and that still continues today. You'll see it everywhere. In Thailand, we have outside every building there is a house, a small house built for the spirits, and that's for the spirits of the property. And so, you know, we have a very rich tradition of, you know, I say it's like we're living in a Disney movie. Every tree is a spirit, every river is a spirit, every building is a spirit, everything is a spirit.
So with that rich animistic theology, is it complemented with an element of what we call, for lack of a better term, shamans and shamanism?
Yes, but I guess we call them mediums here.
Yes, so they are individual ritual adepts that help to connect sort of the celestial to the terrestrial world, as in?
Yes. Yes-ish. I also think that, there are ritual specialists for sure, but the idea of the supernatural is an everyday occurrence too. So
now the mediums, do they use altered states of consciousness and trance? And is there a certain, ethnogens or means of obtaining some sort of altered states of consciousness that they use? Or is this done differently?
Yes, in some... For me, it's always going to be yes in some cases because Southeast Asia is so diverse and so wide. Yeah. Right? I can think of some specific cases where they do.
So in some cases, yes, in some cases, no.
Yeah. I guess the point I really want to make is that they're all everyday experiences. So even today, it's common to see a shopkeeper. First thing in the morning is they'll buy a bottle of Fanta. And set it outside to give to the spirits because the spirits like Fanta. And that's that is an everyday occurrence.
So this is a vibrant and alive and contemporary religious tradition that does go back hundreds, even thousands of years.
Yes.
Which is remarkable.
It's remarkable for you. It's like an everyday thing for me.
right. But when we think about it here in North America and think about the kind of research I've done, to see that continuity, to see that tether of history and theology is amazing, I would say.
Yeah.
It does exist.
It's also because, I know what you mean and see where you're coming from. Another peculiarity of what you see here in Southeast Asia is that there's a lot of syncretism. So even though we have later Indic religions coming in and Buddhism comes in, they do get blended into this whole scheme of animism. So one of the works that I read, which I can't remember who I'm quoting now, but it's like, yes, you have this whole pantheon of spirits that live around you that you have to supplicate and pay respect to, and then Buddhism comes in, and then the Buddha is seen as the chief of the spirits. Becomes elevated to the point where, okay, we acknowledge that there's a spirit world, we acknowledge it's Buddhism, and the way we do that is that now the Buddha is considered the chief of all the spirits.
Fantastic. Well, that's our first segment. Catch you on the flip-flop, gang.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code ROCKART. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's paleoimaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Welcome back to your Rock Art Podcast. This is the 59th episode on the Archaeology Podcast Network. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. We're pleased to have Dr. Tan, Noel Tan, from Southeast Asia, who's going to be talking to us about his discoveries and recognition of the rock art traditions there. Noel, welcome back. Thanks for that first segment. I was so hyper-focused, we used up all of our time together and I was shocked. So let's kick it off immediately and begin talking about rock art and what we think we know or might know about the various rock art traditions and their relationship or not to the religious expressions there in Southeast Asia.
Sure. So there are about probably 1,000 sites in Southeast Asia that we know of already. One of the difficulties that we've had for Rock Art when I first started, so I've been doing this for about maybe 15 years now, but one of the difficulties we've had when we first started is Rock Art has always been a by the way kind of tradition. So like, you know, you have all these archaeological site reports, say, we go to this cave, we discovered all these stone tools and it's a burial here and all these things. Oh, and by the way, there's some rock art here. And that's been mainly the case for a lot of the early rock art studies.
Yes.
And so, you know, we only have really a lot of scant mentions of rock art in Southeast Asia. And one of the things I wanted to do is to just be systematically record rock art, a rock art site, and be able to do that over time and build that baseline recording. So that's how I started into rock art during my master's in Malaysia. Mm-hmm. And then when it got to my time in Australia, I wanted to do a bit bigger in my study. So I was looking at this phenomenon in mainland Southeast Asia, where you have rock art sites that are also at the same time religious shrines. So you have a rock art site and a rock shelter and a cave, and then there is a Buddhist shrine at the same place or a Hindu shrine in the same area. And I was wondering whether, well, you know, there are more than a few of these sites that I can identify. Is there something going on here? Is there a trend that we can see? Is there like maybe a progression over time? And the short answer is maybe. In some cases, you can see like a long progression of a site being used and being transformed. So like we have a site in Cambodia where you have this what we call prehistoric rock art. We don't have a date, but we know it's pretty old. It's red paintings. And then later on in 10th century, it becomes a hermitage for a Brahmin priest who turns it into a shrine for Vishnu. And then now in modern day Cambodia, people still come back to the shrine to pay worship to the local spirit, which is now enshrined in the carvings and the rock. So you have rock paintings and then rock carvings, and people just keep coming back to this place.
So you have multiple religious traditions that are sort of not evolving per se, but sort of layered on this one.
They just end up being in the same place. And part of the reason, I guess, is because the place is nice to stay in.
Well, yeah. Is there a, you know, in terms of some of the contemporary ways that anthropologists and archaeologists are thinking about it here in the States, they call it landscape archaeology. Is there some sort of enduring nature or characteristics of that space that could be recognized as having special supernatural, religious, metaphorical qualities that induce people to be there, occupy it, use it, and represent their religious theology on the rocks?
Yeah. And then you tie in with the local animistic understanding of, okay, yes, certain spirits live in caves. The Buddha was drawn to caves because it was a good place for meditation. And so all these meanings get layered into sites like these as well. But then you have, sure, you have other sites that have no connection at all. There was one site in Cambodia and then another site in Thailand. There is a rock shelter with a Buddhist shrine inside. And then in the other side of the shelter, there is a little small, tiny rock markings. Mm-hmm. That don't really mean anything, but they were artificial. And then in, mm-hmm, front of this shrine, there are standing stones, Buddhist standing stones that date to, I think, the 9th century. And then I spoke to the monk at the monastery nearby, and he says, well, oh yeah, my monastery has been here for 1,000 years. And then I asked him, can you tell me about the rock art? And then he asked me, what rock art? So we shipped it off in a van, and then we brought him to the shrine, and then you looked at the rock art and like, no, you had no idea it was there. And that's the other story that you have. You have a total indifference to the rock art that's on the site.
Well, that is sort of an ongoing story and a saga. You know, it's sort of a self fulfilling prophecy, you only see what you expect to see, and you only see what is conceptually or culturally part of your purview. And if you're not looking for rock art, or if you're not expecting to find it, you probably won't see it, or you'll see, or you'll miss it, or you'll focus on the elements of the landscape, the cultural, the religious shrines that speak to your heart, and those are the ones that are significant in your cosmological realm, I would guess. Am I correct?
Yeah, and ultimately the point is that they still came back to the same place, right? They still converged in that same,
same
outcrop in the wilderness, which is really interesting. So yeah, we have these two distinct stories of site usage in Southeast Asia when it comes to these rock art sites that become religious shrines. Sometimes you can see a progression over time, over long periods of time. And then sometimes you see a really old rock art, and then 1,000 years later, someone sets up shop.
And there's sort of an amazing hiatus or abandonment of that particular place, but it comes back much later. Fascinating.
Yeah. And so there's very little interaction you see between the religious tradition and the rock art. So I've never actually seen the rock art itself being worshipped. Most of the time, you know, it's just like, okay, this place is powerful. This place has some sort of spiritual potency. And the entire place, like in at least one site, I know that the rock art is protected because there is a shrine on the floor, and no one can get to the rock art because of the shrine.
Do the religious traditions that at least recognize the rock art have any explanation or context for it? Do they know or have an understanding of who or what created the art or the subject matter itself? Is there subjects in there that interlink or
no,
part of
they their don't cosmology? Seem particularly interested in it.
Fascinating.
No, not at all. So there's an entire indifference to the rock art. It's there. We won't destroy it. We know it's there, but it's just there. It's not.
Huh. Is there any relationship between the archaeological elements that are there, be it architecture or the physical remains, and the rock art?
No, that too. There's no, at least that place that where I told you the shrine is in front of the rock art.
Yeah, so yeah.
Because the temple has been there for a while.
So it makes your job a little harder, doesn't it?
It does. You can't say, I want to excavate here, because you can't.
Yeah. What is this rock art? What is it date to? What's its subject matter? Who did it? Why did they do it? What does it mean? If I asked you all those questions, you probably have a somewhat of a hard time occasionally responding. Yes or no?
Yeah, no. The I guess the common interpretation is that they were made by hunter gatherers who lived here thousands of years ago. That's what it is.
So, is the development of the study of rock art in South Asia, where does it fall along the lines of sort of our understanding worldwide in terms of trying to understand its theoretical and chronological and some of its cosmological elements?
So we started out with rock art studies here still just being very descriptive. You know, this is the rock art, this is what it looks like, here's our uninformed interpretations.
Uh-huh.
And then in the last decade or two, we have been getting lots of good science in now. So my colleagues in Indonesia, they've been doing really good dates of rock art sites. So in Sulawesi, in Borneo, we have some of the oldest rock art sites in the world now. They are dated to 45,000 years old. And that's completely changed the way we think about rock art, because I know they are old.
That's amazing. That is some of the oldest rock art sites in the world.
It is. We keep getting consistent dates.
How do they date them? I guess, you know, sort of a thumbnail. What are the images of at 45,000 years ago?
So 45,000 year old rock art in Sulawesi that was announced this year is a picture of a native pig.
Yes, yes. I think I remember seeing that. Yeah. So that makes sense. It's an animal. And
yeah. And before that, we have dates from 43,000 years, 39,000 years. So they're fairly consistent across the board about the dates.
Beautiful. And are they, I presume they're in caves.
They're in caves. They're in proper caves.
And are they are they polychrome or are they in monochrome? Are they just red or do they have many colors?
They are just red paintings, different shades of red, but mostly red, dark purple at the most.
And how does one go about dating the rock art back that old?
So the ones in Sulawesi are dated by uranium series.
Yes.
So it's like carbon dating, but you date
uranium thorium. Yeah.
And they do a sandwiching of the pigment. So they date the layer underneath the pigment, and then they date the layer above the pigment. So you get a really precise date of when the pigment was applied.
Well, that's rather amazing, and that's rather significant. Are there archaeological materials intimate or physically associated with that kind of expression, those cave paintings?
There are. So in some of these caves, we do see, and here the argument is out on whether they are purposely built as decorative pieces or whether they are just byproducts of some sort of manufacture. But you have like flakes, stone flakes with scratches mm-hmm. of them. And these sites are, these sites are still being investigated. So
sure.
the ones in Sulawesi, they're being investigated in the context of, all right, when did humans reach Australia?
Right.
Because we know that they were there around 50,000 years ago. They must have come through Southeast Asia. And so, you know, all these rock art, all these findings that you have from the Paleolithic, all associated mm-hmm. with the movement from Southeast Asia down. We have like 45,000 year old dates in Indonesia, which suggests that there are rock art sites in mainland Southeast Asia that are older mm-hmm. or as old. We just haven't dated them yet.
Right. And what about the corollary archaeological assemblage? I presume that that's some sort of a flake stone, and there are no other figurines or other kinds
yeah,
of...
Yeah, we only have the flake stones, the stone tools, the lithics to find.
Yes.
Not... In the tropics, you don't get a lot of human remains that last that long.
Right. None of those Venus figures, huh?
No, none of the Venus figures.
That would be something, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would really be something. So I'm trying to think if we have any kind of figurative... I don't think so.
I don't think so. All right. So going from the beginnings of rock art, what's the next tradition we see after the... most primitive and incipient sort of animal ceremonialism? What comes next in the majesty, in the evolution of rock art?
That's the thing. So I've been trying to find like strands of, all right, are there ways that we can look at rock art instead of just single sites and
yes.
start comparing sites across the region? So,
right.
so I, you know, I've been just playing around with different ways. A few years ago, I was looking at elephant depictions in rock art.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting because so you have like the really early depictions of rock art, elephants, presumably wild elephants, and they are always depicted small because they are things that you observe from far away because you don't want to be close to a wild elephant.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you get to the historic period where elephants are tamed or elephants become a symbol for the Buddha, then you have close-ups of elephants or larger elephants.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this trend where, okay, prehistoric elephants tend to be small and then they get bigger over time or they get seen as tamed over time. I don't like the word domesticated because you don't
right.
really domesticate an elephant. You don't, back in those days and today still, you essentially capture a young elephant and then tame it from young. That's what you do.
Well, this is just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I remember seeing like an old documentary from the 1930s. And this is a bit of trivia for you, but
yeah,
the guys who made King Kong
yes.
in the 1930s, after they made King
yes.
Kong, they made this documentary in Laos, in northern Thailand,
okay.
where they they filmed villagers capturing a baby elephant. And then 2 days after they did that, the village got stampeded by elephants. There was no more. Right? So, you know, it's not something one does not just simply tame an elephant.
And when does it mess with elephants in Southeast Asia? Obviously, it has terrible ramifications.
So yeah, a few years ago, I came across this. There was this new site in Myanmar, in Burma, that was just discovered. It was a brilliant rock shelter with a really high wall, and you could just barely see the outline of an elephant, a life-size elephant.
Wow!
So you know, it's a large elephant. And then once you run it through D-Stretch and you got the scans of it, you realize that, okay, not only is it a large life-size elephant, but it is an elephant that's surrounded by people, and the elephant has a leash on the neck. So it might very well be the first instance of an elephant taming scene.
That's fantastic. How exciting. Well, we'll catch you at the flip-flop, gang, for the talk to you soon.
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
Hello, gang. This is our third segment, the final conclusion of the three-part story of rock art in Southeast Asia. We're blessed to have Noel with us, Dr. Tan, and he's going to talk about some of his outreach and his educational efforts on the study of rock art. Noel, let's kick it off, and I'll give you the platform here to talk about how you have begun to share your passion for the study of rock art with the online folks as well as the general public.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, like how I said in the start, you know, one doesn't grow up in Singapore wanting to become an archaeologist, right? So one of the first things I did once I realized that, okay, I really do want to be an archaeologist, but there's no way to learn to be an archaeologist in Singapore. So one of the first things I did was, okay, if I can't learn, maybe I should learn for myself. And I decided to start up a website about the archaeology of Southeast Asia. In this website, all I did was to just collect the news of archaeology in the region, and then just post it up as a news blog, just to keep myself and whoever might be interested updated. And that has grown. So I've kept working on this website for how long? 16 years now? 2000.
How many years?
16 years.
16.
Like I said, I'm older than Twitter.
Yeah, 16 years on a website. Boy, the internet, has the internet been around that
2006,
long?
So no, 15 years.
Wow, that's amazing. Tell me how many followers, subscribers, views you have. Give me some sense of the audience.
So the audience, I get it, like, it's not very big. I have, say, between around 6,000 visitors, unique visitors to the website every month. Instagram is about 7,000. I have an email list of about 1,000 people. You know, they get the news uploaded to them. Twitter, I'm on Twitter. So everything's on southeastasianarchaeology.com. So
that's fantastic. So that's your niche. You're known as southeastasianarchaeology.com. Thank you.
Yeah, for a while, I used to be going to these conferences, and everyone comes up to me and says, "You're that guy. You're the guy from the website." And yes, I'm the guy. I made it into a conference paper once. It's quite funny. And it's been my way of keeping in touch with the community and also just being knowledgeable about what's happening in the world. And so I have a resource guide for the Rock Art of Southeast Asia on that website too. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, if you want to find out about, you know, research papers, pictures of sites, it's over there.
That's wonderful.
That's something that I've had for a long time. It's probably like the longest professional thing I've done. You know, it started before I became an archaeology student. Now that I'm still working in an archaeology role in an intergovernment organization, I still run it. It's been very useful for myself, and I hope for people.
So it's a resource for the general public and also for the scholarly community of Southeast Asian rock art, scholars, avocationalists, those interested in that subject, correct?
Yeah. So it's been I feel like a genuine form of public outreach, and I'm quite proud of that achievement.
Well, you should be. That's quite a lot of continuity. I don't have much of anything that I have. I've switched wives three times since then. So yeah, I guess the one thing of continuity is I'm still doing archaeology for like the last 50 years, but it's an endlessly engaging subject matter. Rock art and archaeology is just fantastic, utterly fantastic. I can't tell you.
It does make my work professionally easy too, because you know my job is to keep informed of the goings on in the archaeology of the region. And so, you know, my day job now as the senior specialist in archaeology at the Regional Center for Archaeology and Fine Arts is very broadly to promote archaeology in the region and to improve professional practice in the region.
I would say it's a very, very hard job. I mean, I couldn't even imagine having a job description like that. That's fabulous. What a niche.
It is a very wide mandate. It's really fun. I really get to do a lot of different things.
Yeah, what a great opportunity to outreach to the general public, scholars, to share your enthusiasm and passion for the subject. Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. So of all the things you've been doing and are doing, what are you most excited about?
So one of the things that I'm getting to do for the next year, the upcoming year, is, you know, I've been in this center for 8 years now, and I haven't really done anything officially on rock art, because when I joined, we just finished a series of rock art workshops, and I had to, you know, work on other priorities in the region. Mm-hmm. You know, underwater archaeology, heritage and tourism, you know, there are a lot of different areas that need work on. But finally, I've been able to do something that I'm actively interested in. Because of the pandemic, we've had to change some of our programs online. So this year, we were supposed to have a field school on bones conservation in Thailand. Obviously, because of the situation, we weren't able to do that. So we converted it into an online course, which was successful. We had like 177 participants from around the world. So we, you know, a lot of Southeast Asian participants, which is our main audience. But we had people from Ukraine, people from Peru come join us to learn about, you know, human bone archaeology in Southeast Asia. And that was really interesting.
That's fantastic. What a remarkable accomplishment. Congratulations.
Yeah. Next year, we're able to do an online course on rock art, finally. And that's because from the course, people said, well, you know, why don't you do a course about rock art? And I said, yeah, why don't we do a course about rock art? and quite happily, we were able to do that now.
Is the course free? Is it?
It's a small fee. This year we charged about $20. It's a really small fee. We want to keep it affordable. It's like an introductory level course.
And how long of a course is it? How many particular hours is one, tendered or associated with this material?
It's an 8-week course, and you spend maybe 4 hours a week. And we designed the lectures to be short. So you take short lectures, you take a quiz, and then you have a wealth of other materials to read if you want to. If you don't want to, it's okay. I find that most students do end up reading the supplementary material, which is great.
Yeah. So you said is it 4 classes a week? Is that right?
4 hours a week. So 4 hours a week. Lectures in one go on a Monday, and you can take it whenever you want, because we know that people have different schedules.
Well, yeah. Well, that is quite a commitment to produce that corpus of information on rock art studies.
Well, I don't do it alone. So for this rock art course, we're going to be enlisting a global team of experts. So I have colleagues in Southeast Asia who are going to talk about different aspects of rock art in Southeast Asia. With colleagues mm-hmm. talking about the rock art of the Philippines, of Indonesia, of Thailand. I'll speak about some generalities, but there are other experts than me who are more knowledgeable than I am on rock art. And then around the world, we have experts from Australia, from Europe, from Africa, from the US, and we'll talk about, from South America, we'll talk about rock art in these parts of the world. So, no matter where you're coming from in the world, you will come away learning something new.
Absolutely. That's fabulous. Sounds like a course I should take. It would definitely broaden my horizons, and I'm envious for you putting on such a fantastic platform. That is absolutely wonderful. When does it kick off, Doctor?
It'll start sometime in May next year. So look out for announcements starting around March and April.
Wow, May of next year. Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Well, congratulations on putting together such a complex, sophisticated program, and one that provides such an amazing outreach for the globe, and putting the study of rock art on the world stage, which doesn't often happen.
Yeah, it is one of those rare joys of my job. I do get to do really cool projects.
Well, yeah, this is a very cool project, let me tell you. So is there anything you want to sort of leave our audience as a trailer to sort of talk about, where you've been, where you're at, and where you want to go with the study of rock art in your particular niche in Southeast Asia, and maybe what you want to talk about next?
So in the next year, now that we can resume field work, I've managed to do some field work this year in Thailand. We found a few sites, which is great. Mm-hmm. Okay. And hopefully in the next year or two, we'll be looking at sites in again in Thailand, but also in Laos and in Vietnam. I have had a bunch of sites that I want to get at in the long term. So in the course of my work, maybe 5% of my time is devoted to research. And I usually use that time to just go out to a rock art site in my part of the world and do a systematic recording. And so now that travel can resume, hopefully soon, I'll probably get back into that and we'll get some papers out of that. And I think that's really important for me to just still be a practicing archaeologist, even though these days I'm more behind the desk. And for fun, I've just made a coloring book on archaeology in Southeast Asia.
You have a coloring book on Southeast Asian rock art?
Well, there is a rock art site there from East Timor, not very well known.
Yeah.
But during the lockdowns last year, I decided to make a set of coloring pages for my website audience. If you're stuck at home and you need something creative to do, it was fun for me to make coloring pages. I make coloring pages out of my Instagram feed, and then I share them, and I'm like, oh yeah, people kind of enjoy them, and so I finally got around to making more pages and turning them into a book.
I love this.
So now it just got released earlier this month, it's something that I'm.
No, you're amazing.
Quite proud of, because I never thought of myself as being artistic to begin with.
Yeah, but you're artistic, but also you have ambitions and background in such a eclectic array of subject matters, and you're at the helm of such an exciting series of interactions with all kinds of demographics, all kinds of stakeholders and interesting people. Yeah, I think this is fabulous, absolutely fabulous. Noel, it's really a pleasure to get to know you a bit better. I have to have you back again soon, because I'm sure that whatever we did in this little podcast was just a beginning to try to scratch the surface on what's going on in Southeast Asian rock art And it's
sure. There's so many tangents that we can get off on.
Absolutely.
Southeast Asia is such a diverse place, and there's so many, you know. And we're just scratching the surface. Here, yes. We're just speaking in English.
Yes.
You know, we're talking about such a limited area. You know, most of Southeast Asia doesn't speak English. Most archaeologists in Southeast Asia don't speak English, and that is such a big barrier that needs to be crossed.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Hey, gang, see you next week on the Flip Flop. I hope you've enjoyed our adventures in Southeast Asia with Dr. Noel. And next week, a surprise again. Never know what you're going to hear on the Rock Art podcast because it's always a surprise. Take care, gang. Have a good Thanksgiving.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster, Rachel Roden, Laura Johnson, Max Lander, and...
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.